It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
All right, away we go. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have you all along. Good to see my partner and my buddy. Captain Mike Ward.
Man, it's always good to be here, Sean.
Yeah, a lot of fishing to talk about today, and we're going to introduce our guest in a second, but I know you want updated. At this point where I am, we're going to have to kill a lot of doves, Mike, because the price per dove with my sunflower fencing,
yep.
We're going to put some videos up on this thing. We better kill a lot of them.
Well, you've got, what, you had nine. I think you got
I have made more
now.
Trips. More trips to, I mean... Lee at G&D is like, oh, here he comes again.
Yeah.
Back, more T-post, more step-in post,
yep.
More wire. What you got? I mean,
yep.
you I'm just like Stalag 13.
Panels.
I mean, solar panels.
Yep.
Got, you know, this has been something.
Yeah.
So right now, the first dove is going to be the most expensive dove I've ever shot.
Yeah. It's a learning curve. Those depends on how bad you want to shoot a dove.
It's obviously, it's big time.
Yeah.
Big time. But listen, if no doves show up, I can say I'll just use it to... fence deer out of something.
Yeah.
I don't know. But, you know, now it's sunflowers, but then it could be something else. We'll see.
If the rain didn't kill them.
But the sunflowers?
Yeah.
Yeah, they like the rain.
Okay, well, I hope they like a lot of it.
Yeah, they've got it. Yeah, watering's not been the issue. All right. Talking about watering as well, we'll get into kind of like just the situation here locally. We've had a lot of rain, but hearing Captain Bobby talk about it for inshore, you know, you go a couple tide cycles. It'll clear up once this stops.
Yeah.
You know, we got to get that flushed out. South end of the bay, probably the best water out there, which was nice. I was out there last weekend. It was nice.
Yeah.
Nice on the west. I didn't go east, but to the west, it was nice.
And plenty of fish right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, and plenty of, yeah, plenty of people swimming and partying.
Yeah.
You know, I was one fishing. But by the way, I should introduce our guest because at this point, I have in the studio Whiz Bang and Quasar. Which is, you know, not, I don't know this happens very often. They have the two of y'all on the radio at the same time.
We need
time.
To do it more often.
Marcus Kennedy, good to see you.
Hey, glad to be here.
I've always wondered that, too. Quasar, what is Quasar?
It's a different spelling of Quasar, Q-U-A-S-A-R. We spell it K-W-A-Z-A-R. It's a lost galaxy. And my dad named our first boat that 60 years ago or whatever when he worked for Motorola. And when he quit working for Motorola, kept the name, and I just changed the spelling to K-W-A-Z-A-R.
That is so cool.
But what it means is, you don't tell him what it means.
It's a lost galaxy.
Yeah, but it's the brightest star in the sky,
well,
right?
The galaxy is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not as you know, intellectual as Whiz Bang, but.
Yeah. Well, it's close. Yeah. You know, when I named my boat Whiz Bang, I didn't even think. I don't even know how I came up with the name of my boat. I was just coming in from fishing and thought I got a name of
the
boat.
That was the third time his motor blew up. That was the sound it made.
Could have been. But anyway, I thought about it, and I said, man, Whiz Bang, I don't even know where it came from. It just came out of the sky somewhere and hit me in the head. And, you know, I didn't even know what it meant. And then, you know, through the years, somebody said, that's a whiz bang of an idea, man, or something. I said, well, that means great.
Yeah.
You know, that's a great idea.
No, it's a good,
whiz bang of an idea or whiz bang this, whatever. And
but I've always wondered.
No
Quasar.
Idea.
I've always wondered that. So, very good. Now, another rest of the story. We have, including Mike here, hundreds of years of offshore fishing knowledge in studio. So, let's get to it and talk about it. First of all, your season so far. How's it been?
Been great. We've made three offshore trips, had as fine a bottom fishing trips as you'll ever have. I've made probably half a dozen flounder trips. Flounder fishing's been off the charts. Been really good. As long as you don't try to go on Saturday, it's always rough. Going during the week. We've had every other Saturday, I mean, not just rough. It's been like this tropical storm rough.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the weekend warrior. I know. Because it comes right. Mike said, you go. I'm like, no, I got to go Saturday. And Saturday's... not good.
Been you know, tough.
Yeah, it's been tough for sure. You talk about your trips you've made in bottom fishing, and you're not just talking snapper. I do want to talk snapper with you, but I watch, you know, what y'all, you're catching pretty much the bottom fish that are out there. I mean,
we've
scam
been,
pictures, beeliners.
Yeah, scamp, beeliners, gag grouper. Man, it's been great. It's just been a really, really good spring. We've had a a few years of what I'm going to call a down cycle, where the grouper fishing and scamp fishing, you know, wasn't what I considered up to par. But this year it's just bounced back, cycled up really well.
Do those bottom fish, you think, do they have, with those cycles, do they have like a good recruitment class from, like, if you say, hey, they, if you could know, they reproduced well 4 years ago, so 4 years later there would be is it based on
I don't that, I don't know if it's that so much, because the grouper in particular, kind of like snapper, takes them so long to get to a catchable size. But for several years in a row, we had terrible currents out there, and it made it impossible to fish in 300 to 400 foot of water. Not impossible, but very difficult to fish. And this year, every time we've been, the current's been very slow, makes it a lot easier to fish. And I'm thinking maybe
so they were there. Or they just
possibly, yeah. It was just so tough to fish for them every trip that we weren't catching very many.
Well, I mean, that makes sense that, you know, you go a couple of seasons like that, and then, you know, by the time you get there.
There wasn't as many people catching them because they couldn't catch them.
The
current was bad, and the people going offshore to try to catch them, they couldn't catch them because the current was bad.
Yeah.
So 3 years later, when the current gets good, the fish are there.
You stocked them up.
Yeah.
It could be a hunt.
That's kind of like, you know, Mother Nature regulates itself in so many ways, and that's one of the ways. You know, we were talking earlier about the speckled trout were kind of tough to catch for a few years, and then all of a sudden this year they're better. And, you know, snapper got a little tough to catch for a few years, and everybody started blaming it on the loose regulations and state regulations. But all of a sudden this year, man, it's really, really good.
Yeah, and there's something to be said for pressure, human pressure on critters. They will react. You think about land-based. People say, well, I've got hogs on my place. We're going to ride around and kill them all. I said, well, good luck.
Yeah.
The first three, four, yeah, you're going to get them.
Yeah.
After that, they have, Mother Nature has a way to make sure they're not as available. You know, you put pressure, then you let the pressure go, and the population comes back up, they get shootable again.
And it's kind of that way with fishing, too. I mean, if you want to catch the biggest fish down there, that's usually the first or second drop. After that, you're not going to catch.
Which is depressing on some of my trips. So my trip Sunday for snapper, that was depressing the first couple.
Yeah.
Had to step on them and make them 16, but, you know.
Well, sometimes you have to do that, Sean.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes to get a limit.
But, you know, and let's talk about that, too. When you're fishing out in your 300-400 feet, let's say we're scamp fishing, how long do you – I know everything's probably relative, but how long do you lay with the spot?
Well, Marcus, if I'm looking at my bottom machine and it looks like there's fish down there that I want to catch, you know, I may stick with it 20, 30 minutes. If I look at a spot and it looks marginal, we'll make two or three drops and that's it. Move on.
You'll move.
Spot. Yeah.
So you don't camp out on them.
No,
if it's not happening.
No.
I think it's.
I'm not patient. Most people get more patient as they get older. I get more impatient as I get older, and it served me well. Just keep moving.
Well, I mean, the folks I know that catch fish, whether they're inshore or offshore, are like that. I mean, they know if this is not working, just sitting here and beating your head against the wall,
no,
it's not going to make it work. You know, you talk about electronics, and we were actually, before we came on, we were talking about electronics, all of us, but that changed. Technology getting better and better. How's it changed your fishing? Has it changed your fishing?
Technology with the trolling motors is a big deal. You know, having spot lock on the trolling motors. I don't have a trolling motor on my big boat because I've got the spot lock with the Yamaha Hellmaster. That's like magic.
What I've been hearing. Mike was talking about
this. I just push the button and it holds me right there. And so
that's a game changer.
Yeah, I've always been able to do that with my engines, but I had to do that and not fish. But now,
right, Captain never got to fish.
You know, now I can push the stay here button. The boat stays right where it's supposed to, and I can fish and help the people on the boat fish. So that's been a big technological advancement. Now the GPS mapping software also, there's just an unlimited number of natural bottom spots that's available to the public, just in the 3D GPS mapping that you get. You can put it on your Garmin, Simrad, whatever, and find spots. And then the quality of the bottom machines is off the charts. I've got a couple of transducers on my boat. One of them is 120-degree beam width, which means if I'm in 200 feet of water.
Yeah, what's the footprint of that?
I'm looking at about 400 foot of bottom with the wide beam transducer. And then my other transducer, I've got a much narrower beam, a 10-degree beam, so I can find
broad stroke
the vicinity
and
of it,
yeah,
and then go to it and get right on top of it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too, that broader beam. And listen, there's a lot is in the captain's hands, but finding a spot, you know, or finding different parts of it. Like, we all have, I got this number, but there's a piece of it over there, a piece of it over there, a piece of it over there. Be able to find that. It's a,
and you know,
the old days, I burned a lot of gas doing that.
I'll run the thing, you know, if I'm running 40 miles out, I'm running 40 miles an hour, and the thing reads, and I can see the bottom just right. And if I happen to run over a spot, I don't have to stop the boat and go back and look for it. I just pause the bottom machine and hit waypoint on the mark on the bottom, and it puts that waypoint on my GPS, and I can go back, and it's dead on accurate, you know.
So you, I've never thought about pausing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that. I mean, it's the greatest technology. I mean, just like Mark says, I mean, with the all the new electronic stuff and all the, well, electronic too, as far as like the ham master pushing a button and you're sitting right there fishing. But yeah, it's gotten way better than what it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Right. There's no comparison. Can go, I mean, we can do like you've, and I do old Loran jokes and, you know, we're 88 numbers or what do you got. But you said 10 years, it's every couple years it seems to be moving. Like, it used to be you could have a machine 10 years old and like, hey, it's close to what stuff's coming out today. Now, if you two years, I'm like jealous of what people have now.
Yeah, everybody wants something new. And, you know, that's what the manufacturers want. You know, they come up with the latest bells and whistles and hope somebody's there to buy it.
Now, let's talk about, when we come back, we'll talk about it. You talk about the finding more spots out there with that bottom relief. And how much is that, you think, spreading out people versus, concentrating people? We'll continue a conversation because I got Quasar and Whizbang in the studio. It's a great thing. Coming right back, more of FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, Mark Kennedy, our guest this week, and so many questions here. Talk about bottom fishing. Talk about the cycles too. Scamp. The scamp I saw on one of y'all's trip were none of those scamp you got to measure. Those were...
No, nice fish.
Those are...
Yeah, all of them over 10 pounds.
I mean, magnificent scamp out there. And I want to get into what you think on the biology of them. Before that, though, self-serving, 100%. A guy that's really bad at catching scamp. Say there was a guy. His name was Sean. Catch red snapper, do that. But scamp is always, where am I not going? What am I not doing?
Well, to be consistent with it, you got to stay out in 300 foot or more of water.
Okay.
I mean, you know, southeast of here, we frequently get them in 150 to 200 foot of water. Kind of hit and miss, and they're smaller fish. But the bigger fish, you typically have to fish consistently in 300 foot plus. And you have to have really good conditions. You know, it can't be rough, can't be a lot of current. You know, things got to be just right for it.
So, and with doing that, is it all live bottom, or are you focusing on like wrecks out there, or reefs, or like
95% of it is live bottom or rocks?
Okay. Right.
You know, may not be alive, but it's
natural bottom.
Yeah, limestone outcroppings, rocks, things of that nature. You know, we use live bait most of the time, but we also catch quite a few of them on, you know, jigs. So,
is it I see a lot of people using those, I don't know the right name, flutter jig or something like that.
Just a deep drop, slow pitch jig.
Slow pitch, that's it. Yeah, slow pitch.
That's kind of gotten vogue, you know. It's not as effective as live bait, but it can be very effective if you know what you're doing with it. You can't just let it down and whip it back to the boat. You know, you let it down and you slowly drop it up and down, and make sure you keep it in the zone where the fish are. And very frequently, if there's scamp or grouper there, they'll hit it.
So talking about scamp, but Marcus, do you see any difference of where you find scamp and you find other grouper? Are they kind of in the same areas, different areas? What do you see?
Well, there's some overlapping between, especially like the yellow edge grouper and the scamp. We catch yellow edge grouper out 400 to 600 foot of water. Scamp's in that 300 to 400 foot range, so there's some overlap there. You know, we'll catch scamp in 250 foot of water sometimes, and you get the gag grouper in there. Gag grouper, red grouper seem to be in the 150 to 250 foot water range.
But, okay, so if we're going down the hill here, you know, so red probably the shallowest, or
gag grouper, you know, 100 to 200 foot, 250 foot. Then once you get past 250 foot, the scamp are more prevalent. And then once you get out to 400 foot or so, you got scamp and yellow edge grouper along with the snowy grouper and things that are deep drop fish.
So there is a chance. Like people say, well, I don't have the boat. I'm not going deep dropping. But you know, you start talking about 300 feet of water.
Pensacola, you know. Orange Beach, a lot closer than here. Dolphin Island.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at 60 miles.
Okay, to get in that water. Beeliner's also a conversation we're having. The cycles.
Yeah.
Like this is because I mean everybody's saying beeliners are great this year.
Yeah, the National Marine Fisheries Service and Gulf Council was a little bit concerned about beeliners a few years ago, looking at a downward trend in beeliners. Then all of a sudden here the last year or so, they've really came back with a vengeance, especially this year. Used to, we never caught many beeliners, especially the bigger ones, till we got out in 200, 250 foot of water. But this year, we've been catching them in 50 to 100 foot of water.
So that's what I'm hearing. Okay, so I've been hearing that too, and I said, yeah, be kidding me. Because I grew up with the idea that until you're at 200 feet of water, you weren't seeing beliners.
Well, they're
nobody
shallow.
Told them?
Yeah, yeah, they're shallow now. I mean, you know, now we'll say this. We've had a cycle of really blue-green, blue offshore water come in close this year. You know, we had several weeks of hard southeast wind earlier in the spring. We've also had an eddy off the loop current that come in here, and I think brought in some blue water. All that sargasso weed that come in, well, that came from offshore. Brought in a lot of mahi, you know, dolphin fish.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking maybe also that that good offshore salty water got in that 50 to 100 foot range, and beeliners move around a lot more than like red snapper and other reef fish.
So they don't have the same fidelity to this reef or this.
No, they'll move around in schools, kind of like the yellowtail snapper off of South Florida. You know, they'll move in and out. They don't necessarily migrate like the other.
No, but they're not home bodies. Like you can't say, well, this group of fish, a beeliner's is on the spot, so they're going to be there.
Yeah, they might be there 1 week and gone the next, or they may hang around for a while. Just they're not as homebody as the snapper and grouper.
That explains it. I mean, because so many times I've been like, oh, yeah, y'all, we caught them, you know, 2 weeks ago out here. And we show up, and my buddies like, sure you did. We caught them, you know, we're catching a red snapper, but no beeliners.
Yeah, any of your commercial fishing buddies will tell you that, too. You know, they just, big masses of beeliners will show up all of a sudden, and then they'll move a big distance. And kind of like they get on the shrimp in one area, and then all of a sudden those white shrimp out in the Gulf will be somewhere else way off. You know, beeliners move around a little bit like that.
That explains a lot.
Do you think some of the new structure, like pyramids and that type stuff, has brought the beeliners in even closer?
Surely it's got to help. You know, the more habitat you've got, the more fish you're going to get.
Sure, because, I mean, they're not going to be out there on just regular bottom. They're going to be on some kind of a structure, just are in deep water. They're going to be on
hard
rocks
bottom or
pyramids, whatever. Yeah.
Yep.
So I'm sure that's probably made a little bit of difference with all the reefs and wrecks that people have been putting out and all the pyramids and everything. That probably has had something to do with them coming in a little closer.
And think about this, having Mark in here, I get to ask the question here. All right, you have a choice. You can, we call them chicken coops. Who keeps, was it Powers, keeps saying chicken transport devices, because that's actually what they are. But what we all call coops. If you had a choice, you can fish pyramid, you can fish a coop. I mean, you fish, you know, concrete pyramid structure of some sort, or a transport device.
I like
same depth of water. Yeah, everything else is same.
I like fishing the concrete. It's like we get a better diversity of fish on the pyramids. It's like, you know, you catch grouper, trigger fish, snapper, the chicken coops. It's like red snapper magnets. You know, that's what you're going to catch on those, it seems like.
So pyramid, because probably maybe more bottom to top relief or something gives you.
Don't know if a different type of growth gets on it. You know, it's concrete. It's more like limestone, more like the natural bottom that's out there.
Right.
And the chicken coops, not so much. Now, when we sink stuff, we sink chicken coops because they're less expensive and they do really well for at least 10 years.
Yeah, that was the other thing I thought. Like, they say they catch more snapper off them faster, right? So you agree with that. But there is a longevity, you know, issue where the pyramid's going to last you a lot longer unless it gets covered up or moved.
Right. Yeah, we've got some chicken coops that are out in deep water that's been there forever. And I don't care what you put inside of about 100, 150 foot of water, you're subject to getting them covered up or messed up by the storms and things of that nature.
This is good. So it's I won't put you down for concrete.
Yeah, like concrete.
All right, very good. Mike, because we've had this discussion many times.
Yeah. Okay. Powers likes the pyramids.
Well,
not the pyramids, chicken coops.
He said, for just like Mark said, though, he said for red snapper, he said, absolutely, but you got to think about them moving and, you know, being replaced over a decade or something like that, where that pyramid, as long as something crazy doesn't happen, it's going to be there till we're all long gone, you know, unless it gets covered up. You think about other fish out there in the snapper world, too. Your theory on mangrove snapper, you know, that, you know, I had a theory when we were catching them a lot on some of the real close in stuff, bridge rubble. I said, you know, maybe it takes bringing the red snapper population down from harvest enough that the mangroves get a chance to eat. Do you think that, I mean, their aggression versus a red snapper, if they're mixed on a place, do you have anything that?
Yeah, the red snapper are always more aggressive. I mean, you can be out and look and they'll be in your chum line and you'll have a dozen red snapper and a dozen, you know, black snapper, mangrove snapper, whatever you want to call them. And you'll catch 3 or 4 to 1 red snapper over the black snapper. They seem to be a little more finicky. And it's not as many of them, but they're out there and there's not regulated near as much as a red snapper, but they kind of self-regulate because they're harder to catch.
Yeah, those jokers in close, right? I used to catch them on the rigs and stuff. We'd catch them, but, you know, I mean, I'm not telling anybody anything they don't already know, but, I mean, it was croakers and light leader and, you know, chumming. And,
yeah, no matter what you're doing, if you catch a few, it's over with after about 5 or 6 at the most.
Do you think they talk? They say, hey, listen.
They must.
So grouper regulations, we get back to that. This is interesting because we're thinking about it. We mentioned with trout earlier. You know, regulations seem to maybe be trailing what is really happening out there, that they're reacting to something.
Yeah. I mean, that's just the way it works, you know. I don't care if the government's regulating fish or something else.
Yeah.
That they're chasing problems. Sometimes I think they invent problems to chase. But anyway, we've just got hit with these new scamp regulations that's going into effect in 2027. It's aggravating, you know. I don't think the scamp population is in near the demise that they say it is. But
well, I mean, everybody's catching.
Yeah, granted, there were 3 or 4 years there where, you know, it was a downward trend in catching scamp. I don't necessarily believe it was due to a degradation in the population. But
you said earlier, currents not being able to get to
them. Yeah, you know, it's tough to fish sometimes.
Right.
We had several years of bad currents out there during the late spring when we like to go catch the things. And, you know, they're going to shut it down for January 1st through June the 30th in 2027.
Okay.
And they came up with a allowable catch of about 450,000 pounds a year, and they've given 81% of that to the commercial sector and given the remaining 19% to the recreational sector. So I think just like they did with red snapper, I think they've really underestimated the population out there, and I think they've really overestimated the recreational fishing pressure on them. And we're stuck with that.
How do they come up with that? 81% for commercial and 19% for recreational.
Here's what they do. I mean, the commercial catch of just about everything is well documented because the commercial people come in and for years they've had to document what they caught. You know, they're selling it, so it's documented. Recreational anglers, you know, we just recently started to have to report how many red snapper we caught, and more recent than that, how many amberjack or how many triggerfish we caught. So I'm going to call it guessing when it comes to things that we don't report. And they'll admit, the delay in this scamp regulation is due to them not really knowing how many scamp the recreational sector catches. Right. So they'll pick a window in time and say, okay, in this 10-year span, the commercial sector caught this many pounds of, say, scamp. And over that same 10-year period, we're going to guess that the recreational fishermen caught this many pounds of scamp. They add them together, and they say, okay, it looks like in that window that we picked, the commercial people historically caught 80% of the scamp, and the recreational people caught 20% of the scamp. So now that we're going to divvy up the pot, we're going to give the commercial guys 80% of the quota and give the recreational people 20% of the quota.
Yeah, traditional.
That's what they do with all the
traditional
fish.
Use, you know, or whatever.
With red snapper, it's about 50-50. I mean, that's just been a nightmare for many years. But they do the same thing with amberjack, triggerfish. Now they're doing it with scamp. They've done it with gag grouper, red grouper. Everything they divvy up like that. And the biggest problem is it's a lot of guessing. You know, they say, well, we've got these models. Well, the models, time and again, have proven to be very inaccurate. There's huge amounts of error injected. But they'll hide behind the mandate in the Magnuson-Stevenson Act that requires them to use the best available science. It doesn't say use the best available science if it's good science.
They just, yeah.
Use it. It doesn't matter if it's bad science, and frequently they'll admit it's bad science, the data's bad, but we're going to do the best we can.
We have heard that from the feds before. We're moving for, even though this is not right, we're moving forward with it.
Right.
You know, and hearing you lay this out, you could probably educate me better, but there's an equation they're laying out there, but I think there's a missing in this equation. We're missing one of the sets, because if we're saying here is the commercial harvest of scamp, and it's 81, we're then assuming that the recreational caught the other 19. I mean, that's not a given. The commercial's a given. You're now assuming the recreational caught that much. We don't know that number, but they're building the rest of the – they're solving for the equation using this unknown.
Yeah. You know, the first thing they don't know how many scamps out there.
Yeah.
Okay. They're having to guess how many scamps out there in order to devise a total allowable catch. You know, they want to make sure the spawning ratio stays at a certain percent. And, you know, when you're guessing how many fish is out there and you're basing how many fish it's okay to take out of that guesstimate of the overall population, then you're having to guess at how many fish the recreational sector is catching. You wind up with a situation where you have a regulation, but it may not match reality and it may not be what's the best for the resource.
That's for sure. All right, coming back, more of this conversation, then we're going to take it to King Mackerel. Mike has been painting a bleak picture to us here on the show, and I know you're out there.
We're going to let Mark explain the king mackerel situation.
You mean the ones that I used to sit with the Mr. Champ's plug and catch on the cap rigs right
there? I got pictures of them. They are real, and they used to be there.
Okay, coming right back. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have y'all here. Remember to check us out over at facebook.com/FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. And post up maybe pictures from this last weekend or what you got going out there. We'll check them out and talk about those next week. Our guest, Mark Kennedy, the Quasar, which I now know what the boat name means after all these years. We talked a lot of bottom fish because I'm obsessed with them and scamp a bit, but the king mackerel world here, to hear the stories that Mike's been telling me and y'all's trips, it's different days, man, from what it used to be.
Yeah, things are tough, man. The king mackerel just aren't here anymore. This started maybe 20 years ago west of the Mississippi River, and then it started a decline here about 10 years ago, and then the last 3 or 4 years king mackerel have just been very, very difficult to catch here.
So what's happening, Marcus? Give us your, I mean, you're on the water, well, you can chase them a lot.
My theory is this. I think this applies specifically to king mackerel and probably to cobia, wahoo, hardtails, any of the coastal pelagic fish. I just don't think they like it here in the summer anymore. Here in recent years, the water temperature has gotten really hot early in the year. Okay, not quite so much this year because we've had a lot of bad weather in June, but the last few years we've had 90-degree surface temperature in the coastal waters here starting in early June, and it lasts all the way through September.
And you pointed out during the break that 90 might have hit August.
We might have a couple of weeks in August where we had 90-degree water. Okay, now.
Not June.
And now, in combination with that, we've got a documented hypoxic zone, dead zone, off of the Mississippi River, and another one very similar, just not as big, off the mouth of Mobile Bay. And in recent years, those two hypoxic zones have grown in size to the point where certain times of the year they hook into each other. So we've got a massive hypoxic zone that runs from the vicinity of the mouth of Mobile Bay all the way down to the mouth of the Mississippi River and then way west of there.
And that's a problem too, right? We're the Fertile Crescent. That's why our fishing was good, but you can't be too fertile. I mean, there's God's plan, there's a certain amount of fertility, but if you go over that,
right, the microorganisms that are dying, fall to the bottom and sap up the oxygen, and so you get a hypoxic zone. So every year we have fish that migrate up the west coast of Florida in the spring,
Right.
King mackerel being one of them.
Right.
And when they get here, this has been a big spawning area for them for many years, you know, south of Dauphin Island, Horn Island, over around Chandelier, big spawning area.
Okay. I didn't know and, why they came. So they spawn here.
Yeah. And so the last few years, we've seen fewer and fewer and fewer of these fish showing up in the spring. And I just think the temperature of the water and the condition of the water is just not any good. On top of that, we've had a really big decrease in menhaden, you know, pogies. They've just about, I would bet there's only 20% of the long-term average population left up here in the North Gulf now.
And those are, they're really tied together.
Yeah.
Pogies and kegs.
Yeah, that's the beginning of the food chain for king mackerel and stuff like that, tarpon. But, so we've got water that they don't like because of temperature and lack of oxygen. Then we've got a lack of, bait fish for them to eat. And then,
well, no wonder they're not here.
They don't like it here anymore, you know. And the thing about it is we've got two stocks of king mackerel that we have access to, just like cobia and wahoo and stuff. We've got a wintertime stock that stays here year-round out in 300-400 foot of water. Okay, we catch them during the winter when we're trying to tuna fish out there on the salt dome and the lump and stuff.
Okay,
those fish typically would be out there all winter, and they would come in a little bit during the spring, May and June, and we still catch a few of those fish. But the big migration of fish that comes up from Key West up the west coast of Florida on the beach that really shows up here in earnest typically by the middle of June have not shown up in earnest the last several years, and they're just not here anymore, you know. So if you want to catch king mackerel, if you want to catch a tournament-grade king mackerel, one that's over 40 pounds, I could just about guarantee you one anywhere between the mouth of Mobile Bay in South Pass of the Mississippi River, anytime between May and October. I can't do that anymore. If I had to do it, my life depended on it, I would say, okay, I'll do it, but it's going to be between November and March. You know,
yeah, we can go out there in the winter. Telling me the winter fish, yeah.
We can go catch them in the winter, but they're not here in the summer when we're used to them being here.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, to think about that for kings, because we talked about it for other species. Yeah, kind of growing up, just had this idea that it was just this migration, this circum-gulf migration coming up the coast. And yes, that's true, but there's these fish that do other species, too. Ling or cobia, one of them.
Yeah.
There's a group that does the migration we're thinking about, and then there's this north-south migration. So,
right.
Like, I don't know if those two groups develop separately or whatever, or maybe it's a insurance that if one gets knocked out by something, the other one's still there. But you're saying kings do that same thing. There's a group that's kind of homebody,
yeah,
north
stays
south
here, yeah. And I don't think they're ironclad gonna stay here or not. Some of them might get mixed up and go back with others,
right?
And some of them that usually migrate may stay here, but like right now, king mackerel fishing along the beach, say the piers and close in, is okay. It's not great, but you can catch them. But these are typically smaller fish. You know, these are the 10 to 15-pound school kings with an occasional nice one mixed in. Those fish don't seem to be as affected as much as these bigger fish that typically are a little bit further offshore that migrate up.
You think it's a bigger fish, bigger demand for oxygen
in
the
water? I'm thinking maybe the deal is the surf area is oxygenated more.
Yeah, it's like an aerator.
And the temperature is able to fluctuate more, and it's just a better environment, especially for these smaller fish, and they're feeding on cigar minnows and herring and bait fish like that. So it's just not as affected as this 100 to 200 foot of water range that's really where the big hypoxic zone is south of Mobile Bay, and where the big hypoxic zone is off the Mississippi River. And that's where we've historically caught these bigger tournament-grade type fish.
I've got to ask you a tough question. I mean, it's just tough to think about the fishery. Are the days gone? Days of that gone, or do you
I
think?
I fear that they're gone for my lifetime, because if the stock has collapsed, it takes a king mackerel 20 years to reach, 45, 50 pounds. They're slow-growth fish. They're not like a cobia. Cobia or ling, a five-year-old fish will weigh 60 to 70 pounds. They're like a mahi. They grow really, really fast. And that's another thing.
I never knew that for king, that it takes them that long to get to it. A 40-pound fish could be 20
years
old.
Uh-huh. And so, it's going to take them a long time to recover, if they can recover. I mean, if they require a certain water temperature and a certain level of oxygen to spawn, and they're not liking it here, they're not coming here to spawn. If they hadn't found somewhere else to spawn, then, you know, what happens? And this isn't due to any fishing pressure, not due to commercial fishing pressure, recreational fishing pressure. The commercial nor the recreational sectors have come close to reaching their quotas over the last several years.
That's just a tell.
You know, normally when fishing depletes population, you see a spike in catch rate for a few years and then a decline. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it's just been a gradual decline for many years in the catch rates. And the fish just aren't here anymore and they don't like it. And related to that, you know, the federal government was late putting regulations on cobia, meaningful regulations on cobia. 15 years or so ago, the fishermen started saying, hey, y'all need to look at this. There's fewer and fewer cobia. And I think what happened was they started getting caught in the spring. As soon as they shut down red snapper fishing in April, all of a sudden people started catching a lot more cobia because that was a redirection of effort. Because
I got a boat. I'm going to go do something at Saturday, yeah. Marcus.
And so, anyway, the cobia population was annihilated. But the government just
– But you said they can rebound faster than they can.
They only grow – you know, they grow so fast that they come back. They get sexual maturity real quick and they should have come back quickly because several years ago they put a limit of one per person and six per boat. And then a couple of years ago they cut it down to one per person, two per boat. Mm-hmm. So with that type of strict regulation, they should have bounced back really quickly, and they've not. They may have come back a little bit, but it's still, you know, we get a little bit of a cobia run in the spring and a little bit of one in the fall, nothing compared to what it should be. And perhaps that's due to the same thing with the king mackerel. Maybe they don't like it here anymore. Maybe the environment is not conducive to a good spawn anymore because of the hypoxic zone and the water being too hot.
You know, it's scary to me because you say, okay, if those fish are alive, but they're coming up and they're not finding what they need here, the spawning zone, well, maybe they spawn somewhere else. But we've been shown that they wanted to spawn here because it was successful.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
The formula was here. Maybe they find another area, but it may not have all the boxes checked.
Right. If they have found another area, there's a lot of people looking for them,
mm-hmm.
and we ain't found them yet.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is a Gulf-wide deal. I've got buddies in Galveston, Texas. There's no king mackerel over there. I've got buddies in Tampa, Florida. The springtime migration that they're used to seeing is nowhere near what it used to be.
And why? You have an explanation for that right now.
Well, there's another thing that added to this problem, and I wasn't aware of this, or I was aware of it, I didn't correlate it, but one of my buddies in Tampa said, look, we had really bad red tides down here for about 2 or 3 years. We also had a really bad bout with this blue algae due to runoff from the Okeechobee.
Yeah, it made national news. Yeah,
I mean, and it killed just tons and tons of fish. You've seen them floating up down there, jewfish, grouper, snook, trout, all kind of fish were floating up dead, and they had to shut down a lot of that.
Yeah, Florida shut down fishing.
To try to get them to come back.
Yeah.
Well, those fish kills correlated exactly with the spring migration of king mackerel through the area.
So that was happening as they were coming up from Key West.
But unlike all those other fish that have a big air bladder that float up when they're dead, the king mackerel and Spanish mackerel too don't have a very big air bladder, and they sink when they're dead. So it could have killed a ton of those fish as well, and they
had no way to count them,
and nobody knew they got killed. So,
coming right back with this, we'll finish up on find something positive. Mike, you can tell us a story. Something when we come back. More of FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, always a treat. We don't get to do it often enough. It's been some years. Bart Kennedy, talking fish of the Gulf. I said we'd end on something positive. Just got a question here. So I had a story this last week on my midday show about a guy was down with the family vacation, Panama City Beach. He's playing in the surf with his kids. He had a prosthetic leg. He
That's not what you told me at first. You told me
man
first,
lost his leg.
Man lost his leg, and I'm thinking, oh my God, a shark ate him.
He did. Okay. He lost. Mikey lost. Am I lying?
No.
He lost his leg.
Yeah.
It happened to be prosthetic.
Yeah.
It got washed out from under him. They had people looking. By the way, Panama. You see the story. Panama City, fire, police, beach, all have a bolo out. And a description of the leg. They got people looking for, and I think those things are like $25,000, so I get it.
Yeah.
So that story happens, and I just happen to think, because I'm like all of us, if it floats, could you find it out there on a tide line, and would there be fish under it? So it got to be, because that'd be a heck of a story if we said, yeah, we found the man's prosthetic leg, we're taking it back to Mr. Williams or whatever. By the way, look at these fish we caught out. You know,
100
great triple tail, and look at this ling and all that. So I started thinking, with having the two of y'all in here, the strangest thing you've ever caught fish out from under in the Gulf. I mean, in the decades y'all been out there.
Yeah,
what
well,
is it? What
I was telling you, we actually found an arm out there.
Mike, an arm.
Yeah, I hadn't seen one of them hanging around.
An arm.
To start with, we were like, okay. We knew that there were a couple of commercial fishermen missing off of a shrimp boat. We were down around South Pass on a tide line, and we were catching the heck out of dolphin and wahoo on this tide line, and there's an arm. And so we're like debating on whether we needed to go over and gaff that arm and call the Coast Guard and let them know we might have found
part of
somebody that was missing. But
so y'all are easing up. So you see,
yeah, we're worried about it. You know, we're catching fish the whole time, but. Anyway, we see this arm, and it kind of rolled up, and a couple of my buddies like, oh, my God, it's awful, it's awful. And I get up there, and I look. I said, something ain't right. I reached over to get it, and it went tick, and it was a mannequin's arm. And it had been in there long enough to where the part that hooks on the mannequin's body had a bunch of growth and mess on it, so it did look kind of gross. But it freaked us out for a minute. And,
so you've caught fish off an arm.
Arm, yep.
Yeah. I can only picture that reaction, catching fish, and you – drawn to go see what it is, but at the same time, I don't know that I want to see it.
I mean, you know, you see when a you hand, reach, you know, it's calm, but we see a hand come up out of the water like, need to go over there and see what's going on here.
Yeah, we come up, we find that man's legs. Man, we found the leg, but golly, there's a 20-pound black snapper or whatever up under it. Blackfish under it.
Well, I mean, I'm telling you,
gonna catch that fish first.
It's going to be a heck of a story. Hey, Mr. Williams, I brought you your leg back, and by the way, here's some fillets too.
Yeah.
Thank you for having your leg washed out. So an arm out there. I like that. I just picture you saying reaching over to get it, and the rest of the crew going, no. Mike, what's the strangest thing?
Well, I don't have an arm or a leg or anything. I mean, I guess a floating barge out there that you don't normally would see in the middle of the Gulf. You know, a tip of a barge sticking up about 3 foot out of water.
Okay, well, this
we caught some fish off of it.
It's not a body part, but I'm interested.
Yeah,
here.
So
the barge had sunk?
He didn't tell you. He tried to sink it the week earlier for a wreck, and he didn't quite get it down. Or somebody did.
You got to put big holes in it, Mike.
But anyway, that's probably the strangest thing I see. I mean, and it was a dangerous thing because, I mean, at night you could have hit it and, you know, knocked a hole in your boat or something, but it was a tip of it. Just a tip of it, like a V-part was sticking up out of the water, floating, and we couldn't figure out what it was. Went over there, and it was, I can't remember. We caught some fish around. I don't remember what it was, but just floating around out in the middle of the Gulf. I mean, a big barge. It was not a little, it was a big barge, like something.
Somebody might be missing.
I mean, they're missing it for sure. I'm sure it's sunk by now, but I mean, it's many years ago.
So you're coming up and you see something up there. Did you know what it was when you did you say let's
no,
go look at
I
that?
Didn't have any idea what it was. I mean, we saw this sticking up out of the water, and we couldn't figure out what in the water. You know, we're running, and we see it, and we get over there to see what it was, and it's a barge. I mean, it was off of Louisiana. I don't remember exactly
it could be anything over there.
It could be anything. But I mean, a friend of mine years ago ran into a barge that was like that was partially sunk, and knocked a hole in his boat.
You have another friend who hit one of those that knocked a whole foot off his boat.
Yeah. So, I mean.
At Navy Cove.
Yeah. Yeah, you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that now.
Yeah, this is a story for another day when I went down and dove it to get my lower unit back, and I brought enough stainless props up to pay for the whole repair to my boat.
Yeah, how about that?
Good to see you. Thanks for coming in. Let's not make it long again.
Yep, enjoyed it.
All right.
Always good.
do it again next week. Y'all check us out, facebook.com/FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors.